Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English Branch in Washington. Today on the program, we report on a decision by a county not far from Washington, D.C., to change the decision it made 3 years ago to declare English as its official language. Supporters of the original decision said it saved the government money, but critics say it sent a message to immigrants that they were not wanted.
The discussions around the original ordinance, and frankly also during our public hearing at the repeal, somehow made it sound like that English was in trouble.
Then we will report on two new studies that show the sound of a candidate's voice may affect their chances of winning an election.
We are, like other animals, influenced by very subtle cues, audio cues, that are biologically determined.
Then, as we always do on Thursdays, we will present Jill Robbins' education report. This week, she takes us to Cambodia, where education officials have been trying to stop final year high school students from cheating on their exams.
We have seen the change in student attitudes, especially we got a report from the school that they were harder. They attended the additional classes on Saturday and Sunday.
And finally, as always, we will present the making of a nation. Every day here at VOA Learning English, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. More than half of all American states have laws making English the official language. In a few areas, state laws require some government documents to be printed only in English. 3 years ago, Frederick County, in the U.S. state of Maryland, passed just such an ordinance. Frederick County is home to more than 230,000 people. A growing number of them are Latino and Asian immigrants. Supporters of the English-only law say it saved the county government money. But critics say the law sent a message to immigrants that they were not wanted. As Anna Mateo reports, the county government has now reconsidered the controversial ordinance.
Frederick County is about 70 kilometers north of Washington, D.C. The population is 80% white. But Frederick has a growing immigrant community, mostly Spanish-speaking Latino. 2.5 years ago, the county government approved a measure that required official county documents to be written in English. It also required that English be used in all government business. Local immigrant groups strongly opposed the law. Ray Garza heads the Frederick Immigration Coalition. Mr. Garza says the English-only law showed that undocumented immigrants were not welcome. Elizabeth Chung is the head of the Asian American Center in Frederick, Maryland. She agrees with Ray Garza.
I think that using the word English only, you kind of it's a perceptions, it's a projection that, you know, we don't want anybody else in here but only those who speak English.
Jessica Fitzwater was elected to the Frederick County Council in 2014. She immediately pushed to have the law overturned.
It was part of an overreaching amount of legislation that aimed to be of an anti-immigrant sort of flavor.
Councilmember Billy Shreve voted for the measure in 2012. He says the law was never meant to be anti-immigrant. Mr. Shreve says the law was meant to make English the official language for Frederick County. This, he adds, would save money by reducing the large cost of producing documents in other languages.
It basically said the official language for Frederick County that we do business in as a government is English. And if you need any professional services beyond that, you're responsible for paying for those.
But Ms. Fitzwater says she thinks there was more to the measure than saving money.
The discussions around the original ordinance, and frankly also during our public hearing at the repeal, somehow made it sound like that English was in trouble, and declaring English as the official language of Frederick County was somehow going to save that.
Last month, the Frederick County Council repealed the law by a vote of 4-3. Jessica Fitzwater says that sends a new message about Frederick. She says it shows that her community is open-minded and accepts people from different cultures. I'm Ana Mateo.
Experience and money for campaigning increase a politician's chances of winning an election. But so may the sound of a candidate's voice. Ana Mateo is back to tell us more about that.
Two recent studies examined the effect of voice pitch, its highness or lowness. The studies suggest that candidates with lower voices have better chances when it comes to seeking political office. Take the 2008 presidential election, for example, between then-Senator Barack Obama and Senator John McCain. Mr. McCain is a war hero. He had served in the U.S. Senate for more than 20 years when he ran against Mr. Obama for president. At that point, Mr. Obama had represented the state of Illinois in Congress for less than 4 years. In this presidential debate, they offered their vision of the future. Mr. Obama, the less experienced, went on to become president. One reason may have to do with the pitch of his voice, says Casey Klofsted. He teaches political science at the University of Miami in Florida. Professor Klofsted is not saying that Mr. Obama won only because he has a lower voice than McCain's. But in a study published in the journal PLOS ONE, he and other researchers suggest that voice pitch might have been an unconscious factor. The team asked 800 volunteers to listen to voices of non-politicians. The voices were changed by computer to sound higher or lower. The volunteers reportedly preferred the deeper pitch. They linked it with strength, competence, and honesty. Casey Klofsted also noted that the volunteers, in general, preferred candidates around 40 to 50 years old. At that point, he says, people's voices are at their deepest.
We are, like other animals, influenced by very subtle cues, nonverbal audio cues. that are biologically determined. And what we're trying to do in this research is to show that these subtle influences do have an impact on our decision making and how we select our leaders.
Earlier work by Professor Klofstad and his co-researchers found that candidates with deeper voices earned more votes. If unconscious bias toward voice pitch is a factor in an election, some candidates might want to consider voice coaching to lower their tone. I'm Anna Mateo.
Now, it's time for our weekly look at the latest education news. The top education official in Cambodia is praising efforts to prevent final year high school students from cheating on their exams. Minister of Education Hang Chan Naron says he is sure the results will be better this year than they were for the class of 2014. Many high school students are hoping the same thing. Last year, 60% of students failed after the government launched its no-cheating policy. Cambodia's 88,000 final-year high school students took their exams last month. Many are afraid the government's new policy may hurt their chances of entering a university. Our education correspondent Jill Robbins tells us more.
As usual, some students tried to cheat on the exams. A few students were caught with handwritten notes to help aid their memory. One grade 11 student was arrested after he tried to take the exam for his older brother. For the most part, it seems, the new rules stopped the cheating that has taken place for years during exams in Cambodia. Hang Chun Naran is the person responsible for the no-cheating policy. It is an important part of his efforts to reform education. His goal is to replace the old system, which supported cheating, with a culture of merit that helps those who work hard. The education minister started in his current job 2 years ago. He thinks the pass rate will be higher this year, partly because students have studied more. Other changes also have helped, including improved teacher training and extra classes.
We have seen the change in student attitudes, especially we got a report from the school that they were harder. They attended the additional classes on Saturday and Sunday that offered by the teachers.
The minister hopes that honesty in exam taking will begin correcting the biggest problem facing the education system: high school graduates who are not ready to fill jobs. The system has long produced graduates who lack the skills that employers need. Other changes include better training for teachers, increasing their pay, and making improvements to school buildings. Other programs are aimed at improving education for women. As we reported in January, the Asian Development Bank and other donors are providing the money to help improve Cambodia's education system. Fixing the problems in the education system will not be easy, says the minister, but he thinks it was good to start by ending cheating on exams. That policy not only shows weaknesses in the system, he says, it also forces students to learn. I'm Jill Robbins.
Thanks, Jill. That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. The Making of a Nation is coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Last week, we talked about slavery in new American states and whether Congress could set the conditions for statehood. The Missouri Compromise in 1820 settled the issue for a short time. The compromise said that Missouri could enter the Union as a slave state, and Maine could enter as a free state. By approving these two states at the same time, Congress kept a balance of power in the Senate between slave and free states. But the compromise also said no more states in the Northern Louisiana Territory could be admitted as slave states. As a result, slavery could not enter the new areas of the United States. Some people did not like the compromise. They said it limited the ability of slave owners to settle in the country's western territory. Others said the Constitution did not permit Congress to say that new states had to be slave or free. Even President Monroe did not believe the government had the power to make such decisions. Yet he approved the compromise. He was trying, he said, to avoid a civil war. Monroe's decision to approve the compromise did not hurt his election chances in 1820. There was, at this time, really only one party, the Republican Party, and he was its leader. The opposition Federalist Party was dead. It was no longer an election threat. So Monroe was the only presidential candidate in the election of 1820. He received the vote of every elector except for one. William Plummer of New Hampshire voted for John Quincy Adams. He explained later that George Washington had been the only president to get all the electoral votes. Plummer said he did not want anyone to share this honor given to Washington. Monroe's first 4 years as president had been successful. He had increased the size of the United States. Florida was now part of the country, and the problem of slavery had been temporarily settled. There had been economic problems, some of the worst in the nation's history, but the situation was getting better. And the nation was growing. As it grew, new problems developed between its different sections. There were really three separate areas with very different interests. The northeastern states had become the industrial center of the nation. The southern states were agricultural, with large farms that produced cotton, rice, and tobacco. Much of the work on these farms was done by slave labor. The western states were areas of small farms where grain was produced with free labor. It was a place where the land did not cost much and where people could make a new start and build a new life. This division of the nation into different sections with opposing interests ended the one-party system of Monroe's administration. The industrial Northeast wanted high taxes on imported products to protect its industry from foreign competition. This part of the country also believed the national government should pay for roads and waterways to get their products to markets. The South did not agree to high import taxes. These taxes raise the prices on all goods, and import taxes on foreign goods might cause foreign nations to raise import taxes on Southern cotton and tobacco. The South also opposed spending federal money for roads and canals. The mountains through parts of the Southern Atlantic states would make road building difficult and canals impossible. The Western states supported government aid in building roads and canals. The Ohio and Mississippi rivers were the only inexpensive transportation systems for moving their products to markets. The Westerners also supported high taxes on imports because they believed such taxes would raise the prices of their agricultural products. The separate interests of these different sections produced an exciting campaign in the next presidential election. Each section had at least one candidate. Several had more than one. The campaign began almost as soon as Monroe was elected for the second time. At one time, as many as 16 men thought of themselves as presidential possibilities. By 1822, the number had been reduced to 6 men. John Quincy Adams was the only Northern candidate. He was an extremely able man. He was at the time Secretary of State, and there were few jobs in government he could not do and do well. But many people found him cold and questioning. His father was John Adams, the second president of the United States. The West had two candidates. One was Henry Clay of Kentucky, popularly known as Harry of the West. He was a great lawyer, congressman, Speaker of the House, and senator. The other was Andrew Jackson, known as Old Hickory, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812. Jackson knew little about government. He was a fighter, a man of the people. In the election of 1824, Jackson got the most electoral votes, 99, but he needed 130 to win a majority. The Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, was second. Treasury Secretary William Crawford was third, and Henry Clay of Kentucky was fourth. Because none of the candidates got a majority of the votes, the decision went to the House of Representatives. The House voted on only the three top candidates for president. The most powerful man in Congress, Henry Clay, was not, therefore, a candidate. But Clay's support would be the greatest help any of the candidates could receive. All three wanted his support. Treasury Secretary Crawford had suffered a serious illness before the election, and his health was bad. Clay felt he could not support him for that reason. This left Adams and Jackson. Clay did not agree with all of Adams' policies, but he did believe Adams had the education and ability to be president. Clay did not like Jackson, the hero of New Orleans. He knew Jackson was poorly educated and easy to anger. Clay did not think Jackson would be a good president. So Clay decided to support Adams for president. He said nothing about this for a time. Several of Clay's friends visited Adams. They told him that Clay's supporters in the West would be pleased if Adams, as president, named Clay as Secretary of State. Adams told them that if the votes of the West elected him president, he would put a Westerner in his cabinet. But he would not promise that the Westerner would be Clay or that the cabinet job would be Secretary of State. Clay had still not said publicly which candidate he supported. But late in January, a Philadelphia newspaper published an unsigned letter. The letter charged that Clay and Adams had made a secret agreement. Clay, the letter said, would give his support to Adams. In exchange, Adams would name Clay as his Secretary of State. Clay was furious. He not only denied the charge, but offered to fight a duel with the letter writer. But whoever wrote the letter to the newspaper refused to say anything. Clay was sure Jackson's supporters were responsible. Snow was falling in Washington on the morning of February 9th, the day that Congress would elect the president. At noon, members of Congress walked into the House of Representatives. Each state had one vote for president. Adams was sure he would get the votes of 12 states. Crawford had the votes of 4, and Jackson, 7. New York was the question. 17 of the New York congressmen were for Adams, and 17 were against him. Adams needed just one of these votes to get the vote of New York and become president. One of those New Yorkers opposed to Adams was a rich old man who represented the Albany area, Stephen Van Rensselaer. Although Van Rensselaer had supported Crawford or Jackson, he really was not sure now whom to support. When the New York congressman voted, Van Rensselaer was still not certain. He put his head down on his desk and asked God to help him make the right choice. After this short prayer, he opened his eyes and saw on the floor at his feet a piece of paper with Adams' name on it. Van Rensselaer picked it up and put it in the ballot box as his vote. This gave Adams the vote of the state of New York and made him the next president of the United States. 2 days later, Adams told President Monroe that he had decided to offer the job of Secretary of State to Clay. He said he was doing so because of the Western support he had received. Clay accepted the offer. Now Jackson was sure that Clay had sold his vote to Adams for the top cabinet job. He wrote to a friend, "Was there ever before such barefaced corruption? What is this trade of vote for office, if not bribery?" Jackson, himself a senator, showed his feelings when the Senate was asked to approve Clay as Secretary of State. He voted no, and 13 other senators joined him against the nomination. But they were too few to prevent Clay from getting the job. With Clay as his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams began his first term as president. His administration will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.